This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
It takes a lot of hard work to make it look easy. This Mother's Day, Duluth Trading Co. can help you give her something that keeps up. Whether you prefer to shop online or in-store, Duluth has a motherload of gear, goods, and gifts to keep her comfortable and capable, no matter what needs doing. With Duluth's problem-solving details and legendary durability to boot, you'll finally be mom's favorite again. Check out DuluthTrading.com for all your Mother's Day gifting needs.
Hello, I'm Rob Beckett.
And I'm Josh Widdicombe.
Welcome to Parenting Hell, the show in which Josh and I discuss what it's really like to be a parent, which I would say can be a little tricky.
So, to make ourselves, and hopefully you, feel better about the trials and tribulations of modern-day parenting, each week we'll be chatting to a famous parent about how they're coping.
Or hopefully how they're not coping.
And we'll also be hearing from you, the listener, with your tips, advice and, of course, tales of parenting woe.
Because let's be honest, there are plenty of times when none of us know what we're doing. Hello, you're listening to Now That's What I Call Parenting Hell, Volume 4.
So then you started stand-up when your daughters, when your children, the older ones, were teenagers, is that right?
Yeah, two were in double figures and one was very young.
And how did the kids react to that?
Well, Josh, for the longest time, I was doing open mic in, you know, buttfuck. They didn't know what I was doing. They were like, you're not reading. Well, anyway, I never read Goodnight Stories and all that because they don't do it in India. And I thought it was always so tedious. So it's not like they missed that.
But what about bath time?
No, bath time. No, they have a bath. What am I going to do? I mean, of course, they're not that small. When they were small, I was in the bath. I didn't want them to drown. But as soon as they could have a bath, I was like, go have a shower. What are you doing?
So what age would you let them shower alone?
You know, when they were like a reasonable age, whatever, like, I don't know, 6, 7. One of my kids had a habit of going into the shower and coming back and coming out and with a totally dry face. And I'd be like, who are you kidding? I was like, how is this possible? He said, no, mommy, I did. I said, you did not. You did. Come on, dude. Come on. And then by the time it was like, really the only time your kids know is when they're friends or you're on YouTube or TV. I mean, otherwise, how do they know? They don't.
Yeah.
And I think for me, that was probably, I think it was maybe when I did Have I Got News For You, which I did very early. Maybe, I don't know, you know, very early and it just happened. And I think my son was he asked me, were you on Have I Got News For You? And I said, yes. He said his science teacher had asked him. And he said, I said no to him. And I said, why? And he's like, why would you be on TV? And I was like, okay.
That is a real confidence booster.
Yeah, but I think the other thing is I didn't used to talk about it at home really because it's just something I did that was not, you know, like for the kids, I was still always a full-on mom. I was still taking them to school, waking them up, going to see their football, packing their lunch. Who has the time in between telling them to stop beating each other up and get their shit together and get in the car to be like, oh, by the way, I'm doing stand-up. Like who? Nobody. You know, and I've always been quite demanding academically of the children. So by and large, they don't like to talk to me.
Are you quite a stern mother, like quite strict?
I mean, I'm told I'm strict.
Who by?
Everybody in the house.
What about like other kids of friends and family? Have there been things you don't like going on in your house and you've had to impose your stricter rules on other kids?
I wouldn't do that to other people's kids in our home. If they come, they behave badly. They're my guests. They can. You will see my kids looking at me in utter panic. Like, oh my God. And they look at me in like, they're like terrorized because they know what it means to me. But they've also understood. We have a phrase in Sanskrit, which is Atithi Deva Bhava, which is the guest comes as God. So you do never criticize your guests. You know what I mean? No matter what. But when they leave, I look at the kids and they're like, we know, we got it. We saw it. But I think there's a very strong code with the children, you know, about what's done and what's not done.
So when you say, because you were obviously, you don't do the bedtime stories. What are the other British, not parenting traditions, but kind of parenting norms that you find kind of baffling like that, or just like...
Well, I mean, baffling, you know, I do know, I can see why you guys tell stories and it's nice. I'm not fucking doing it. It's not even like that baffling.
I'll rephrase the question. What other things are you not fucking doing?
What else do I not do? I don't really play with them.
Okay.
Like I play, they're around me playing.
Yeah.
Like now I play with them because I've taught all of them how to play rummy and three-card poker. That's fine. But yeah. I won't play like fucking, you know, Lego schman. No. I've been a kid. I did all this.
But don't you find that nostalgia going back to those games and doing something together? Don't you like get a buzz from that?
No, but I do other kid things with them. Like, for example, you know, I've always been a little bit cavalier with this bedtime business, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's when they were very little, then you have to because you need a routine and blah, blah, blah. But like, say when they're 4, 5, 6, 7, like when they've started school, I mean, before they go to nursery, I don't care when you sleep. When you fall asleep, I'll pick you up where you are and then that's it enough. Thank you. But if we're going out and you're going to be sleepy and then, you know, misbehave, then we have like, don't do that either. So my husband is like, you have no rules. These kids just have to adapt. I'm like, yeah, that's pretty much right. But every once in a while, you know, there'll be something we want to do. Like there'll be a TV show that we all want to watch and it's like past their bedtime. I'm like, screw the bedtime. Let's watch. Or like, you know, if there's a movie that we really want to watch and somehow we can't watch on the weekend, I'm like, let's watch it now. The one thing that I don't have many rules around like dessert and ice cream and whatever, like just fine. It's in the fridge or we have this, eat it. You know, like just use some sense.
So would you say you let the small things go, but big things you come down on them quite hard?
I think so. I mean, the things that kids do, which are interesting to both kids and me, I'm there. Like I took my children alone when they were 4 and 2 to Disneyland by myself.
Oh my Ooh. God.
All the way to Los Angeles.
From London?
Well, I went from London to Atlanta to attend my cousin's wedding. Which was a great wedding, by the way. And then from there, I was like, well, I'm not going back to London. We're already here. So I was like, let's go to LA. And my husband was like, I can't do it. I'm like, that's fine. I got this. So there's those kinds of things, which I think a lot of adults are like, are you crazy? I'm like, no, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. I'll be fine. And we had a great time. The other thing I used to do, which the kids later told me they had never heard of anyone doing, was I really like Pixar. Okay? Like, really. So when the first few Pixar movies came out, there used to be one every 18 months. Like when my teens were young, I used to not want to go on the weekend because everyone brought their kids and kids would talk and it would be like a kiddie movie event. And I'm like, I don't have fucking time for this. So I used to go on the first day that the movie came out, which is usually a Thursday or Friday. And I would go to the school. I did this with both of them, go to the school, tell the school there was a dental appointment or something. Get the kid out of class, and the middle of the day, we would go to the movies.
I bet your kids loved it.
Oh, my God. Well, I didn't tell them because, you see, kids will tell their friends. And so I would just do it, and I had to, because both my kids have my husband's gene of being very honest, they would look at me with their eyes like saucepans. I'd be like, remember the dentist? And we would leave, and I'd be like, dude, we're going to movies. And their heads would explode. And I'd be like, but here's the thing. If you go and tell your friend tomorrow, I'm going to go to jail. So they never told. They were like, oh, shit. And now they tell me that was so bad. Like, we were so scared.
But you're generally hard on them academically. Does that not go against that?
One day of missing school, you're going to not get you're not going to get 10 on 10. What's the matter with you? One day?
He loves being negative. And that's what happens to teenage boys. Mm. They just want to shit on your dreams for the sake of it, right? So, for example, his school, about a year and a half ago, had a trip to Auschwitz. They had a trip to Auschwitz. The whole year we're going to go. And I thought, obviously, with our heritage, that'd be a good thing for him to do. And, you know, bleak and awful, but also very important or whatever. So I say to him one breakfast, you know, Ezra, I think you should go on this trip. That'd be good. And he's like, nah. And I'm like, no, really? Look at me. Take it seriously. I really think a lot of our relatives died. There might be a good thing for you to do. And he goes, none of my friends are going. I go, okay. I really think it's important for you to go. And he says, no, I can't be bothered. And I found myself saying the actual word Ezra. I don't have to force you to go to Auschwitz. But, you know, he lives for memes. Irony, an incredibly high level of irony, being like scornful about me and that video games and FIFA and stuff like that.
Does he respect your career?
No. I mean, secretly, but I think no. Certainly, he loves saying today. I know a lot of people are working from home, but if you've got a family, it's often a good idea to think like, I'm going to go and write somewhere else.
Yeah. Right?
So I'm thinking about doing that. So I went into a flat today, and I'm afraid to have to tell you, my friends, that I had a mask on, but nonetheless, I'm there with the very young estate agent, and he says, oh, so you're going to come and live here? I said, no, I'm going to use it just for writing. He went, oh, what, are you a writer? And I went, well, yeah, I'm a writer and comedian. He went, oh, right, all right. And I told this to Ezra, and he just said, yeah, what you wanted was a 50-year-old bloke who likes football. And I thought, right, yeah, Ezra, I know. You could have been nicer, mate. You could have said that's his fault for being ignorant or whatever. Not, yeah, well, young people don't know who you are, Dad.
But young people do know who you are because
yes.
You've sold 1.5 million
Children's
books.
Yeah, here's one. Oh, actually, we're not on the telly, on the internet, but nonetheless.
So your new children's book, Future Friend.
Yes.
Which, so how many have you written? Is that five?
He's written 1.5 million. Yeah. He's sold one each. It's a good way to get into the million books sold.
That's not very well. I've written seven children's books. And one, actually one, and a novella. So seven and a half children's books.
And why did you go? Was it partly to impress your children or entertain your children? Or
well, it came from Ezra, the idea for the first one. I mean, actually, I was having a row, not a row, but a thing today. I think The Guardian are about to do a...
You talk about Ezra like Tyler Durden in Fight Club. It's like it's just your split personality living with you.
I don't know if he really exists. I was having there's a constant row on Twitter and sometimes elsewhere. Like I think The Guardian are doing a piece about how comedians and celebrities should not write children's books, right? Because it causes, it means that, you know, probably true at some level, not that they shouldn't, but that it does create problems for those people who want to write children's books who haven't got like a pre-established name or brand or whatever. Anyway, my point being that I didn't particularly think, oh, I want a bit of that David Walliams action. My son gave me an idea, is what happened. When he was eight, he said to me, Dad, why doesn't Harry Potter run away from the Dursleys, obviously the horrible muggle family that he has to live with when he's not at Hogwarts, why doesn't he run away from them and try and find some better parents? And I could have said to him the literary answer to that, which is, well, I think it's because J.K. Rowling wants to suggest that Hogwarts is very magical, and so she creates a very negative, humdrum life for him when he's not at Hogwarts. Well, I didn't say that. I said, because too long. I said, that's given me an idea. And the idea was a world in which children can choose their own parents. And that led to my first children's book, which is called The Parent Agency, about a kid called Barry, who is annoyed with his parents all the time, wishes for better parents, goes through his bedroom wall into a world run by kids in which parents basically have to audition to get children.
Oh, that's a great idea.
And he tries out five different types of parents. And yeah, so I wrote that. And what you just said, Josh, about it being a good idea, the reason I said that was not just being self-aggrandizing, but the reason that I wrote it is that when I had that idea, because of what Ezra said, I thought, that sounds like a really good idea for a children's book. So much so, I thought someone else must have done it, but they haven't. And you know, when you have a good idea, that's often how it feels. Like, it feels so classic, someone else must have done it. And it did do really well. And at that point, I thought, now I do want a bit of that Williams action.
I remember when they were small and that bit where they possibly nap in the afternoon, and then if that doesn't happen, you more or less want to kill yourself. That period is behind me now.
Yeah.
But the flip side is the evenings are off limits because their idea of when they should be going to sleep, of course, is like, I mean, a 10-year-old is basically a teenager in terms of how much he demands to stay up. So, yeah, again, the routines of the day just get shifted.
I think I'd take my evenings over... if you offered me to lose 2 hours of the evening to my daughter staying up, but I gained 2 hours in the morning, I think I'd prefer to lose the time in the morning still. Yeah. But the evenings are...
I don't have the... I can't offer you that anyway. I don't control it, obviously.
Also, Mark, with the... So, obviously, the kids splitting times between the two houses and stuff, do you ever sort of clash slightly on the parenting? And is it harder to sort of, like... you know, agree on how it should be done when you're not, you know, there together the whole time?
It's certainly
quite
not
smooth.
Yeah, of course, kids are quite good at exploiting, again, in football terms, they will slip between the two central defenders. They'll tell my ex that we did that at dad's house and vice versa. We have to cooperate to sort of put the pieces together, because the 10-year-old in particular is a sophisticated sort of cheat now. He'll always claim that he gets certain privileges at the other place, or that he's already done his homework there. Or you have to both have your mind switched on to stay ahead of it.
And
there has to be a lot of cooperation. And sometimes I've got better at just accepting that it's not going to always go well as well. Yeah.
Because we have a lot of people email in and solicitors and stuff that are sort of separated and have to, the kids split time between the two parents. And it always strikes me, it must be so difficult. Even if you do have a good relationship after you've separated, it's difficult to make sure they're all telling the truth and stuff. But if you didn't get on that well with your ex, it must be impossible if there's not that, you know, because some cousins, friends of mine growing up, and you see that they'd have to be dropped off at the end of the road type thing, and then they don't actually see each other.
Rob, didn't you, that the only reason you're staying with Lou is because it would be such a nightmare to be divorced. That was the words you used.
absolutely right. I don't...
Money-wise, especially, yeah.
Oh, I tell you what, that it is fiddly, yeah. I don't 100% recommend the process if you can avoid it. And we were kind of, it was a little bit acrimonious for a while. We were never quite at that leaving them at the end of the road stage, but things are sort of reasonably equitable now. And even if they weren't, you'd have to make them, because your mental energy for like fighting people is almost zero when you're also fighting with the world the way it is at the moment.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
So in some ways, all of us have learned to get better at, like, all of the interpersonal relationships have had to get better, because otherwise you just can't manage. Yeah. But that takes mental energy as well. And there are days when you sit there and think, well, I think it's a case of have a glass of wine and forget about everything here.
Yeah.
And by a glass, I'd mean quite a large glass, potentially.
What's it like when they're not there and then they turn up? Like, so you're seeing them for half the week.
Yeah.
So does it feel like you're living kind of two different lives in a way?
It really does. Sometimes especially because my partner and I run sort of a production company as well from this house. So a lot of the time there's a lot of work going on. Things feel orderly here. Everything feels, you know, it feels more or less like being a proper human being. And then you're aware that within 15 minutes of the kids being in the house, it will resemble a circus more than a workplace.
Yeah.
And, what I've tried to get better at is not bracing myself too much for that. If even as you're picking up the kids, you feel tense thinking, oh Christ, here we go. That is not a good thing to project to them probably. No. So these days I try to, kind of accept, like, mentally accept the chaos. It's like, I tell you what is a bit easier is being able to take them to, you know, cafes or to the cinema. And the worst bit for me was when there was literally no building outside your house that it was legal to set foot in. At least now I feel like not everything has to be in the house. But you're right, Josh, it is basically like, for the last few months I've felt like the halves of me that are and aren't looking after the kids are almost two separate people. There's a person that can get quite a number of tasks done in a day, and then there's a person that has to cower in a toilet to get a single email away. If you're parenting these past 6 months and you don't regard your bathroom as the office, then you're doing better than me.
What a place.
A door with a lock on it has become so, so valuable in this period.
Yeah, mine's worked out the old 10p trick, though, where you can just undo it for the other side.
That is that a thing?
Yeah, you know, like if it's one of those locks where it's not a key, It's a little like...
Oh,
like
it's a turning thing.
Like a turning, like a little turning knob. On the other side, there's a little slit like for a screwdriver, a little you can get a 10p in there and turn it.
Well, wait a minute. I don't think I'll allow them to listen to this in that case.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they probably shouldn't be for all sorts of reasons, to be fair. Bloody hell. I don't know if you should be publicising knowledge like this, Rob. This sounds borderline criminal for me.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, I wouldn't endorse it, but it can be done.
You haven't exactly distanced yourself from it either, though.
I was going to say, well, how do you sort of do Christmases and stuff like that then? Do you sort of have a year with the kids or a year not with the kids, or is it sort of a bit more
fluid? It took a little bit of time to work it out, and the past 2 years we've done Christmas Day itself with our respective new setups, and then we've done things all together on Christmas Eve and Boxing Day.
Oh, nice.
For the past 2 or might be 3 years, it's been Winter Wonderland on Christmas Eve and then pantomime on Boxing Day. Oh. But of course...
Who were you playing in the pantomime?
Oh, just a set of bit parts for me. I've
back of the donkey.
Yeah, Chris Whitty was the lead, obviously. and it is nice. And that kind of Christmas Eve, Boxing Day, I then tend to take them to my parents later in that bit between Christmas and New Year where it's a case of, right, what do we do now? But all of this is sort of hanging in the balance, isn't it? I shouldn't think there'll be pantomimes, and I'd be very, very surprised if Winter Wonderland is allowed to happen, because that's basically...
No, not happening.
There you go. I mean, I think that's probably sensible, because that is essentially 40,000 people in quite a small field. and a lot of them are pissed on mulled wine and German sausages. I mean, the more I talk about it, the more disappointing it is it's not happening, actually, because Winter Wonderland does sort of look like a hellscape, but it is a great place to entertain kids for 4 hours.
So what happens at a Winter Wonderland? I've never been to Winter Wonderland.
Well, if you haven't got kids, it would be a weird decision to go, I think. But basically, it's a big old, like a theme park. So you've got your helter skelters and those rides that someone like me looks at them and immediately throws up, like awful-looking rides. But then there's also this... either German or fake German market with booze and sausages and stuff like that. So it is quite a good place,
isn't it?
It's all in Hyde Park, and traditionally it gets so muddy that it's more like being at Glastonbury. It's in a lot of ways it's quite an unpleasant experience, but it is a place where the kids can have quite a nice night, and you can get quite drunk. In all fairness.
Guilt-free.
And those are as close to guilt-free as you can be, getting pissed with kids. Yeah. And also, if you go like in the afternoon, evening, it obviously gets dark, it's Christmassy, it has that sort of, it's the sort of thing that you are aware that the kids are, they're forming nice memories, even though you're looking around thinking, well, there's too many idiots here, and that was just £14 for a mulled cider there.
Yeah. It's expensive, isn't it?
It really is. I don't know how much the actual tickets to it cost, but as soon as you get through, they've absolutely got you. You come away having had quite a nice Christmas experience, but you're about a grand down.
When Romesh went to see Mr. Tumble at Wembley Arena with his kids, obviously, and it was like at 10 quid for a 12-inch hot dog. And he's like, well, do you do a smaller one? And I was like, no. Is that 3-year-old?
It's absolute.
12-inch hot dog that you weren't eating any of.
Those kids' arena shows are unbelievable. I took my kids to Paw Patrol Live at the O2. I know, which is the bleakest sentence I've ever said out loud, like? I think. Have you seen Paw Patrol?
Yes, they're big fans in my ass.
Right, well, imagine that, but shit. imagine that, but instead of sort of lovable animation, it's just people, you know, pretending to be dogs. The main thing with it was it wasn't the O2, it was, again, Wembley Arena. it was the sort of place that, you know, 10 years ago, you might have seen Arcade Fire. Now you're watching a bunch of blokes pretending to be dogs. And going to stuff on that scale, like going to music venues, but to see kids stuff, really reminds you of how your life has changed, I think. Like you're thinking,
what happens
last
time. Paw Patrol Live?
Sorry?
What happens in Paw Patrol Live? It's just like, how long?
I can summarize it for you very easily, Rob. Hardly anything happens in it. You basically, what happens in Paw Patrol Live is everyone responsible for putting on the show makes an enormous amount of money. Because as with Romesh's hot dog story, there's any amount of dog merch that the kids all want.
And I can't believe the actors are getting paid well. They're not on a door split.
I don't think... no, it's not. There's not a bucket collection at the end. the actors are, it should be like that, actually. It should be like a free fringe show in Edinburgh. And at the end, they should come and say, well, I think if you'd seen that on the West End, that would have been 45 quid. So if you wouldn't mind putting that in my bucket. but this, it's, someone's making a lot of money because not only, so basically they come out, they do like a, you know, what would pass as an average episode of Paw Patrol, but all of it is they're in costumes and it's done partly by talking, partly by, you know, like voiceover tracks and stuff. There's a few songs and then pretty quickly it's over and the lights come up. And if you banked on passing the, you know, killing the afternoon with your kids, there's this horrible feeling of like, that is that it? So it works out about £17 a minute. And you often get this with shows for the very young kids. You pay what you'd pay for a theatre show and it's billed like a theatre show. But after 45 minutes, it's a case of, there's a particular feeling you get when they begin a song which has the look of an end song about it. Yeah. And you're filled with this cold fear of like, hang on a minute, let's not start singing a song that goes, we've all had a lovely time, it's time to leave the theatre. I don't think it is quite.
So what kind of parenting were you, did you grow up with, Carl?
Well, they were just quite, you know, it's not their own fault. My dad, I don't think, was a particularly, natural dad. You know, he was old, he was 43 when I was born. So there was no, and he's uncomfortable around kids. So like, which is awkward when you've got two of them. So like, we never played with it. I don't remember once ever playing with my dad. You know what I mean? He was just, I think He waited until I was in my teens and we could hold a conversation before he actually learned to communicate. And there was never like, he's never been very loving or, yeah, he's just naturally an old fashioned bloke. Do you know what I mean? He just sits in the corner and sort of grunts now and again and just constantly watches telly. And my mum is quite a neurotic Irish woman who's very, you know, when I say neurotic, I mean to a pathological level. So she was always so stressed and anxious about everything that sort of, you had to, I don't, me and my brothers definitely just sort of went our own way. We were quite independent from a young age because we were like, I think we've outgrown these people by our early teens. So we just went off and, you know, did our own thing.
Because you've always been quite grown up, haven't you? I'd say, like, I mean, I never knew you as a teenager, but I've known you for the last 10, 12 years.
Yeah.
But I think you've always been sort of, even when you were young on the comedy circuit, you was almost like an elder statesman, the grown up, like the older brother of everyone. And you've always sort of been older than your years, I think.
I've always felt older. Like, I remember I started cooking my own dinners when I was at home when I was about 12 because I didn't like my mum's cooking, which is, I think, looking back,
power play.
That is rude, isn't it? Like, at the time, I think I thought, it's just, it'll take the load off her, you know, she doesn't have to stress and, you know, and I can cook myself what I want to cook. And I learned to cook from doing that. But looking back, I do think that is, I'd take that personally if my daughter, when she's 12, go, look, you take a night off, mate. I'll cook myself.
Yeah, not hearing that shit again. So do you think, though, because this is something I've sort of read up upon, where if you were parented in a certain way, you'll sort of almost try and counteract that with your own child. And whereas you were maybe left your own devices and to be a grown-up quite early on, do you think there might be a danger that you may not like overcompensate, not smother your daughter, but like, are you aware that you maybe do too much for her? And then that way she gets a bit mollycoddled.
Definitely. I mean, there is, I'm pretty certain I'm going to probably veer too far that way because and it's mainly because I want her to grow up and like me and trust me and actually be able to go to me.
You're desperate, mate.
Get me the guitar and the cowboy hat. Let's go. Love me, love me, love me.
No, but I think it's quite almost a sad point to it, but I want her to like me when she's older and go to me or feel like she can come to me if she's got problems or, you know, I would never go to my parents if I had a problem. I'd go to my mates. I've got mates who I'd go to way before my parents, but I've never asked them for anything. And it's not just because of their financial situation and the fact they haven't got any money and things like that. It's more just, I wouldn't go to them for emotional advice or anything really, just because I think I was always like, that's not really their forte. Whereas, so I want to be able to at least offer that to my child. So if she's ever in dire straits or whatever, she can actually come to me, not just think, well, I need to go through my WhatsApp list to see who else I can ask.
Would you find that you parent in a different way to your parents, Rob? Not many people know that Russell Kane was brought up on a hippie commune.
Hey, I don't know, really. I'm not yet, really. I think it's more when we were treated like you go out and you get a job type thing at like six. I always worked from like 14 and stuff. And not that I want my kids not to have sort of that same work ethic, but I think the proof will be more with the teenagers. So it's just trying to find that balance of, I don't want to go too far one way or one too far the other, but it's just trying to get that the right balance of, yeah, go out and work because you need to work to get money. But also I think that instilled a fear in me of like, oh my God, we need money type of thing, rather than sort of being a bit more relaxed about, yeah, you go to it, you get some money, but that's not the be all and end all. And I think that's why some people from working class backgrounds can get consumed by the earning of money and getting the Rolex or the flash car and all that to prove that you got the money. So you've got the money, it's all going to be okay. But actually you're sort of running on a subconscious level of fear that it's all going to go away the whole time. So that work ethic they instilled in me was brilliant and really helped me in my career. However, you want to try and make sure it's not too ingrained that it defines you, and then you never stop to relax and go, it'll be okay, we'll get on whatever happens. Do you know what I mean? So I think that's why it's interesting with Carl. When Carl's gone, you know, I'm a bit sort of hip, like hippie-ish and arty-farty to my family, but Carl has gone even beyond with
I love that you are hippie-ish and arty-farty to your family. That is absolutely amazing.
That really paints a picture of your family, mate, in our mind.
It's mental, isn't it? But then, like, you.
Here he bloody is, old Jim Morrison walking in.
My dad, I drove my parents up to see my brother. This was just before lockdown. And my brother lives in Nottingham. And I took my parents and my aunt, Ginny, and like my mum and her sat in the back just talking incessantly, like as old women do, where they just commentate on everything that happens.
And they're all in the baby carrier, yeah? All on the front. No car, no pram.
At one point, I overheard them that we went past one of them big wind turbines, and I just heard my mum go, Jesus, Ginny, look at the size of that, like that, right? And then we went past another one about 3 minutes later, and she went, I know I said it before, but Jesus, would you look at the size of it? She just kept commentating on every wind turbine we went past. And then my dad, this is what my dad's like. My dad got in the car when I picked them up, and I was listening to meditation music. It was just like, whoa. And my dad sat down and just asked, are you listening to Hoovering? That's what I've had to deal with my whole life.
Do you, because you're very kind of relaxed as a person.
Yes.
And parenting is arguably the least relaxing pursuit, you know, at times. Do you find when you're woken up at 2 a.m. or when you're struggling to do something, is it difficult to remain zen, for want of a better word?
So far, I've been pretty good. I genuinely would say yesterday when she had probably the most neurotic day she's had since she was born. You know, what I mean by that is, when their first few weeks, they literally don't know what they're doing, do they? They're just a ball of noise, and they're so new to the world. But so I think then it doesn't really matter if they're crying, because you totally understand that to them, it must be terrifying to come out into the world. But, you know, since she's become much more aware and fun and laughy and giggly, like, she's actually been really, she's a really chilled out baby. And then yesterday was the first time she was pretty much nonstop, quite difficult all day. And that's the closest I've got to not being able to just sort of contextualize it and go, it's fine, she's a baby. Do you know what I mean? That's what I'm quite.
Yeah.
I don't know if you did it, but I read a lot of books while my wife was pregnant. I thought, I just, you know, I've got enough time, I'll just do the reading. And during lockdown, and, you know, just at the start of the year, we were traveling, we went over to Australia and stuff. So I had a lot of time to read, and I read a lot of parenting books and child psychology books, and I think I really tried to drill into myself to never ever think that the baby is doing it to annoy you. That's what I think a lot of parents get into, that mind frame of when a baby, especially once they get to about 4 or 5 months, when they become a bit more conscious, people think they're trying to manipulate you, or they're trying to do, they know what they're doing, they're really needling you, and it's not true. They're not developed enough to understand that. But at this point, 5 months in, I'm still, whenever she's crying or in, you know, I always think of it, I put myself in her position and go, look, she's just, of course she's upset. She's four and a half months old, and there's just been a loud noise or whatever. Something obviously is causing this.
Yeah.
So I'm at the minute, I'm being chilled about it.
There's a still inside you, the little oik from Tooting, Carl, that surely at some point goes, oh, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, a little bit.
It never erupts.
Well, do you know what? The thing that keeps annoying me is, because I've coped with the tiredness really well. So has my wife, when considering she's breastfeeding still through the night. Like, it's unbelievable how she's dealt with it. But I've realised I'm mentally relatively normal. I don't feel exhausted. But I think that's because I'm diverting all my energy to my brain. My body, I'm the clumsiest I've ever been. I knock everything over. And my wife just hears me throughout the day. Every half an hour, knock something over and go, oh, shit, like in the other room. Shit. That's all you can hear just around the house throughout the day. So, yeah, I think I still get annoyed about that level of clumsiness. But in terms of the emotional side, I've somehow managed to maintain this sort of zen. Yeah.
And when are you planning on moving the baby out of the bedroom, like into their own room? Have you got a plan for that, or are you just going to see how it goes?
Yeah, we're just going to see how it goes. I think, we haven't actually bought a cot yet. Which is quite 5 months in and we've not bought a cot. But we are looking at one. So we're going to get one of them probably when she's about 6 months and start seeing if she wants to maybe have her own space and that. And it's very much baby-led.
Yeah, just have a quick discussion with her.
If her first words are, seriously, can I not sleep somewhere else? Bloody annoying.
Let me have my own bed. Get off me. Stop breathing on me, Dad. And why do you wear the cowboy hat to bed? It's weird.
Oh, do you know what? This is gross, but I think I've in the last couple of weeks, I think I've developed sympathy nappy rash with my daughter.
Oh my gosh. This is where the hippie stats come in now for this.
Well because I've always been a naked sleeper, right? For the last decade, I've never slept in any layers whatsoever. I hate it.
The turning point, really? Because I've always been a naked sleeper, but it's only in the last 10 years. Was there a turning point? Just dick was too up?
When she came along and she was in the bed, I felt a little bit grotty with just having my willy flapping around next to her. So I thought I've got to put a layer.
How far down is she sleeping?
That's why they call him the wind turbine. Look at the size of that.
As she grows, I don't want that to be like the barometer, the day that she sort of her foot just touches my knob. I don't want to disgust it. So like I thought, do you know what? Out of some level of, and also because you're up and about a lot in the night.
Yeah,
I thought it's good to at least have a layer on in the nighttime if you go into walking around the house and stuff. So I started wearing a layer, basically a boxer shorts in bed, and because I haven't worn it for so many years, I basically got nappy rash because it's too warm, my bits and pieces are used to having air.
Oh wow! So you having to put on the same stuff as her? You both lying there and putting on your?
I do. Your poor wife. I've got legs up. Let's go, both of you.
So obviously, you have kids, and your focus changes, right? You know, when you used to look at Google images of like fit actresses or like an actor that you rated or a comedian or whatever, and you'd always see that Google image result of them at the premiere of some kids movie with their kids, and you think, oh, actually, that's pretty cool, isn't it? Like one day, like. But you can't imagine you doing it. And then when you have kids, you stop thinking about adult content all the time. You realize everything you do has adult content. And you think, well, it'd be quite cool to have something that my kids could enjoy. So, obviously they were little, they'd watch the CBeebies bedtime stories. And I thought, I know people at CBBC. I don't know anyone at CBeebies, but it can't be that much of a leap. I must be able to stick my nose in there. I started making calls. And I got in touch with the commissioner at CBeebies, and she was like, join the fucking queue, mate. Judi Dench is waiting to do this. I thought they'd just snap my hand off. Yeah, I thought they'd just be like, oh my God, yeah, brilliant. Like, get in there, do something for the kids. So I actually waited years to get on the CBeebies.
Did you?
And by the time I got on it, my kids were too old to care. They didn't watch CBeebies anymore. So it was kind of fruitless. But the other story to it was that I thought they shot it in London, but they shot it in Manchester. I think Children's TV had moved up there. And, you know, Manchester for me was always like, if I'm going to Manchester, because I've got two of my best friends live up there, like, it's always a reunion, you get on it. You know those guys that you know where it's like, if you meet them, you're getting on it. So I meet up with my friends Si and Matt, and obviously we get on it. But I ended up having an all-nighter, and I hadn't looked at the call sheet. So I was just thinking, oh, it'd be afternoon or whatever. You know when your phone rings in the hotel, not your mobile, the hotel room phone.
Uh-huh.
You know there's a problem if your hotel phone rings. rings. And it was like the third time, and reception was like, there's a driver waiting here for you downstairs. You've got to come down. It was like frantic. I was like, oh my God. I was fully clothed, just passed out on my bed. And I just got up fully clothed and just went downstairs, got in the car. And within like, because it was the Holiday Inn at Media City, so it was like 2 minutes away. So within 5 minutes, I was sat in a room with Kerry and this other dude, Alex, who were like the people that babysat my kids while I was doing comedy in those early. So I was just tripping out, hadn't slept, and with the CBeebies guys. And they're just caking makeup on my face. I like smelling salts, trying to make my eyes look
you
less
must
hard shot.
Stank as well, mate.
Oh, mate, I was just so not how I planned to, you know, prepare. My voice was going.
Did they know you'd been out?
I think I probably told someone, probably told the makeup assistant or something. But mate, I was a mess, and I was just really annoyed. But then, you know, people would hit me up online and say, oh, my kids love this telling, or they love that telling of the book. So I think I got away
with the
most
emotional they've ever seen, because you were crying throughout, weren't you? No one's ever seen awful. Someone deliver it looking so despairing.
I felt awful.
Eating the kebab was a bit much. I can't wait to watch that now, knowing
behind the curtain.
That's it for this special Best Of episode. We'll be back next week. If you are not in the queue and you are waiting, then step to the side.
He got in touch and said, yeah, sorry, mate, you didn't seem like yourself the other day. You've only met me 3 times.
The self-service checkout. I don't care what you're called. I'm not getting tricked into working here.
People at festivals in those stupid jester hats.
But do you know what a snake's penis looks like?
£2.69 for a bottle of water.
Why is your Wi-Fi code 10 characters long?
People who do their shoes up.
I don't care if you're watching. Boot cut jeans.
What's upset you now?
Hello, I'm Paul McCaffrey.
And I'm Sean Wolfe.
And we are the hosts of the hit podcast, What's Upset You Now?
Each episode is only 15 minutes long. That is perfect for your commute.
Absolutely perfect. What, a little 15-minute bus drive to work? Stick an episode of What's Upset You Now on. What's it all about, Sean?
Well, me and Paul and a big-name comedy guest such as Tom Allen or Rob Beckett or Josh Widdicombe will rant about what has got our goat that week for only 15 minutes.
All those little things, like, for example, do you know Gatwick Airport are now charging you £5 to get dropped off at their door?
And now the sun's back out and people are off doing yoga in the park again.
New episodes every Tuesday and Thursday. What's Upset You Now with me, Paul McCaffrey.
And me, Sean Walsh.
Hello, Tom Allen here.
And Susie Ruffle.
We have a podcast called Like-Minded Friends. It's very much a celebration of, I don't know, what would you say, Suze, being queer?
Being queer, but also chit-chat. There's loads of straight people that love it, so I think that you should come along and listen to it.
There's something for everybody. It's been described as white noise for gays, but also we had a lovely section about Glade plugins.
So why don't you listen to it? Search Like-Minded Friends wherever you get your podcasts. That sounded quite professional, didn't it?
Mm.